Welcome to Saving the Game. This is episode 16, Faith and Science Fiction, Part 2, recorded March 7th, 2013, with your hosts, Grant, Peter, Brandon, and Ben. You know, we're talking about characters, though. Peter, did you have something? Or Brandon?
I had something, but it was more like, so we kind of jumped off track of that whole discussing example. Admittedly, the journey we took was a beautiful one.
Yeah.
That I loved listening to.
Yep.
I remember we were talking about the whole different, the different ways that we can integrate faith and or religion in a scientific setting. And I know we discussed a couple different ways, and I believe we've covered first using it as sort of a little side character, basically flavor text, and then we've also had it putting a religion in there that is somewhat perhaps a corrupted version or maybe an uncorrupted version of Christianity that comes in a sort of isolated segment of believers. I had another example that I remember from the Stargate series, which was a really unique example about it because it delved into very religious tones while explaining them in science. They were fighting gods, but those gods were aliens.
Right.
And while I also remember that there were no characters that were explicitly religious in the show, I do remember there were a couple side conversations with characters that were, some of them were even enemies, that were like, well, I believe in God, and blah, 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 and God will save us, and we will tell these false gods to go away, and they had beliefs, and it was a part of this scientific setting in the world. Like, and not to mention that in the final couple seasons, the ancients and the Ori, which were the sort of ancient beings that were way more devilish and they had their own little twisted religion, were, for the most part, they were aliens, but it was hard to distinguish them from actual beings of power, and that got in really interesting when a group of people who were just freed from false gods wanted to start worshiping them, because they're like, well, yeah, they're aliens, but how different are they from actual gods?
Yeah, Stargate, I have a soft spot for Stargate anyway.
I have minimal experience to Stargate, so I'm...
I got a box set I can let you borrow. You just got to come down here and get it.
You've got have you got Netflix? Because they're all on Netflix.
Yeah. I have the awesome, gorgeous box set. It's wonderful.
Because my Netflix queue isn't already long enough, but okay.
Oh, no, just add 7 seasons of an awesome show. And
yeah, I need to do that with Battlestar Galactica, too, I'm told. And
oh, Battlestar Galactica is on this list also.
Yeah, I know it's also on Netflix, too.
Yeah. Yeah, but
I have a backlog long enough to keep me busy for several millennia, I think.
Yeah, me too. I think we all do. But yeah, Stargate, I think, is a really good example. I think I vaguely recall some of the main protagonists mentioning in passing kind of a background faith in God. I think that's about as far as it got.
Yeah.
I want to say it was either Carter or O'Neill, but I can't be sure.
I also think that the character Ben Broder played was religious, and I think the general that replaced General Hammond was religious.
Might be.
I also think Senator Kinsey, one of the main villains of the series, at one point mentioned being a religious person. That's the person I remember, because he was always there going like, oh, we will have faith and we will be strong and we'll beat these things, which I've never seen.
Right. Yeah. Stargate's good. It definitely gets into the that sci-fi trope of, are these gods really just powerful, more advanced beings, or are they actually something divine? Which, I mean, that's an old science fiction trope. Star Trek did it how many times?
No, it's still common even in writings today. It's very common and easily modified trope that's relied on.
Sure.
Well, I've seen it in fantasy also. People go, well, are the gods anything special? I mean, if a mortal can be elevated, especially in worlds where a mortal has been elevated to God, it becomes this, like, well, if he can do it, why can't I do it? And if I can do it, why worship them?
Right. Is he really a god at that point? You know, what is
Forgotten Realms. Yeah, Forgotten Realms tackled that issue, what, 15 years ago?
Yeah.
I think a long time ago when they did their Spell Plague and before that.
Yep. It's not quite a spoiler, but Skyrim, one of the side plots, if you will, is a political squabble with a little bit of religious overtones about this particular set of humans who have basically added a human to the pantheon of gods that everybody on the continent worships. This is Talos, for those of you who've been playing. You know, it's, well, here's this human, and we're pretty sure that he became a god. And, you know, the elves are like, we believe in all the same gods except that guy. Because no. No way. And you get that split there. So
isn't Torm supposed to have been a former human, too? The Forgotten Realms, wasn't he? Didn't he start out as a human?
I believe
so. The lawful good paladin god with the greatsword and dragon and stuff.
And then later on you have, what, Mistra and Sirik, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, the lawful neutral death god was a human.
Yep. Kelimvor.
Kelimvor, yes.
Very compassionate death god.
He actually really is. I played a priest of Kelimvor in the worst game I ever played in. This was a game where I didn't have... This was D&D 3.5. I didn't have a single stat below 60.
Holy
and
cow.
And none of it mattered. None of it mattered. All right?
Wow.
This was a gaming nightmare like you would not believe. Worth discussing in detail another time, because it's...
Welcome to Whose Game Is It Anywhere? This stats are made up and no one can.
Yeah, it was actually... Yes, that was it exactly. The stats are made up, the combat will go as long as the GM feels like, and...
So what were you saying about railroads earlier?
You have no idea.
Oh, I do. I've been in those games.
This is one of the great old railroads from back in the old-timey days, apparently.
Yeah, the old-timey days of 2005 when we should know better. Just saying. I'm going to write up that gaming nightmare at some point. Anyway, and it's interesting that we brought up Transcendence. There's been kind of an uptick recently in transcendent science fiction. You have this transhuman idea.
Ah, yes. Yep.
There's been a lot of that lately. There's a game all about it that I cannot remember off the top of my head.
Eclipse Phase. It's Eclipse Phase.
Eclipse Phase, yeah, yes.
Yep.
That's one of them. Diaspora brings it up in certain ways. There are certain civilizations that... at the top end of the technology tree, are about to go through this transhuman transfiguration, if you will, that is indistinguishable from mass casualties. It's a science fiction trope that I don't have a lot of experience with personally, I don't know that we have a lot to say about it necessarily, or at least I don't, but it's out there. And that idea of humans ascending to something else is something... You know, it'd be interesting to contrast that with
Christian you run up against beliefs. That even in like modern astronomic theory, right? You know, people looking out for signs of hyper advanced civilizations that would have things like Dyson spheres.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So I think it's definitely a trope you can play with, and that's definitely out there.
I guess in that sense, you would look at it as, you know, first of all, if you're going to play a game in that sense, like Eclipse Phase, find out what the setting is about. What are the ramifications if you have a character with a particular set of beliefs or, you know, ideologies, and how does that mesh with the setting itself? If you see the potential for good play in that sense, or, you know, if you really want to do a good campaign, then by all means, you know, look into it. But if it looks more like, it's pretty much a dogmatic approach to this is what we believe, this is how we think it should be, and there's really no room for people who think like you, then, you know, it's something to steer away from.
Right. I mean, I personally would love to play somebody who's maybe a little leery of the way technology's headed. You know,
right.
It'd be an interesting thing to explore. But if that's not how the game is structured, maybe set that character concept
aside. Gee, that's not topical at all in a world with, you know, augmented reality and personal drones and stuff around the corner.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
well, I know, like, for okay, so, like, Eclipse Phase used to be done by Catalyst, and then the guy who did it, Adam Jury's a friend of mine, he split off with Rob Boyle, who was the line developer for Shadowrun. Both of these guys are very, their ideology is more atheistic, anarchistic, transcendental, transhumanism style.
Right.
And so they kind of took that and ran with it as far as a game setting that jumped ahead several hundred years and then infused those beliefs into that. So it's kind of built personally from a personal perspective from them as to where it is. But the guys who they have, who helped them do the writing and the rule set for them are very atheistic, not necessarily tolerant. Uh-huh. And, you know, I think that's a shame because, you know, they invited me to write for them. And as I explored the setting, the more leery I felt about it. I didn't really think I could explore the type of character development, the themes and things that I want to do in that particular arena. So, you know, I just, you know, politely stepped aside for it and wished them the best, you know, in their endeavors. But that's why I say, you know, you've really got to explore, read about the setting, explore it, find out what the tenants are, where are they going with it, is there room to explore that type of character, you know, is there tolerance for that, you know, that kind of stuff. It really is a spiritual gut check when it comes to those.
And it really is unfortunate, because I remember I was going to be in a play-by-post game of Eclipse Phase that wound up falling apart, and there's fun and interesting stuff to play with in the setting. Another mutual friend of all three of us on the podcast, Chuck, was going to play like this nano swarm of basically robotic insects, and I was going to play this other guy who had like hollow pouches basically in the sides of his abdomen, and you know, it was going to be an infiltrator team and stuff. So you can do some fun, like really weird out there characters, and they work in this setting, but yeah, there's some philosophical stuff in there that doesn't sit well with religious belief.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, the earlier example I was using about Shadowrun, the games that I used to run for it, you know, it really does come down to, you know, if you like the setting and you like the ideas, pick and choose what you want to use out of it. And then, you know, set the others aside. If you really find that to be an interesting aspect, you know, use what you want from it and toss the rest of it out. Doesn't mean that you have to follow the setting exactly. But, you know, again, all things have to be, you know, evaluated for, you know, personal impact. And some of these things are good challenges and some of these things are just bad influence.
And there's nothing to say that you can't just crib lots of inspiration from a setting that you that you like and just discard the stuff that you don't want either. In fact, I think probably a lot of us that are veteran GMs probably spend a huge chunk of our GMing careers doing just that. I really like this element. The rest of the setting's kind of, you know, toss it over your shoulder, sound of breaking glass. Okay, on to my next, you know, setting book on my bookshelf.
Yeah, and it's not even from setting books. I mean, you know, we are creatures of our accumulated experiences. It's, oh, hey, I read this cool idea somewhere. I
saw this on this TV show. This was great in that video game I played, you know?
Hey, fate chips are a very interesting storytelling concept. I think I'll put them in every single game I run from here on out.
Yeah, or
right. But, you
know, that was very evident in that I ran a 4-year Star Wars RPG back in college, and, I mean, I did that. I pulled all kinds of stuff from everywhere into the stories that I would create for these guys. I mean, I had, I think at the end of our, we started with 4 and we ended with 30 people in the group. And we had all kinds of stuff going. Do you want an interesting sidebar on this? Cause
how do you run a 30 person gaming group?
Okay. So when West End put out their game, I was in high school and I know it's still the best. West End put the game out, and my brother and I collected all the books cause we still are big Star Wars nuts. And when I went to college, I took the entire collection with me, and, I ended up getting a bunch of guys on my floor very interested in it. And we started out with a group of 4 or 5 guys who played some of their stock characters. And we started Manhunt and Tatooine, I think, was the first module we ever did. And what ended up happening is that's how I really discovered I really like telling the story. You know, I was a Star Wars geek at the time. I knew all kinds of stuff. I had all the books. I knew the stats and everything and the history and all at the time, the history. And Heir of the Empire had just come out, and, you know, we devoured it, and I started incorporating some of that into
it. It was a great book.
Oh, yeah. So what ended up happening was the guys loved playing it so much. We started playing they wanted to play two or three times a week, mm-hmm. but not everybody could coalesce their schedule. So what ended up happening was one night I might play with a smuggler and his droid companion. Another night we might play with the whole group. Another night we might play with a new player and incorporate them into the story somehow. We'd have side trips and side missions. We'd have the Force character. He went off on a 6-month, not a sabbatical. He went off on a 6-month exploration, and he and I did solo games because he worked at the same place I worked at, and the only time we ever saw each other was when I was working, when we were working. So we did games because I worked at a movie theater. We did the RPG while we were there.
There you go.
And then I would incorporate elements from that story into the other story, so they knew what was going on, and we had recurring villains, and then we started bringing in more people the next year, and pretty soon we had a roving, probably about 3 times a week. We played a few hours at a time, so we were talking short or, you know, medium range campaigns, and I would take modules and pull some, a planet off of here, a storyline off of there, a character out of here, a ship from there. One night might be a Star Warriors game. You know, another night, you know, I still remember the night I dropped a Super Star Destroyer on them. They just freaked out completely. But what ended up happening is we ended up roving where we never had the same mix of people in a consistent basis. And we kept going through, we started with Before New Hope, and we started rolling through the movie trilogy. It was going on in the background of our campaign. And before I knew it, we had, I think, 28 people completely involved with a character at some point playing at some point within the month, any given month, playing various side adventures. I had volumes of notebooks with character arcs. And this is what I would do, because I would drive to work, because I worked through college, so I had 3 jobs. So I, on the drives that I had or on the walks back and forth, I would sit and think Star Wars arcs, campaigns, story ideas. I'd write them down. I'd craft plot lines. And I think this is really what helped my writing career later on in organizing, because we would have, Jodo Cast, I think, was one of the early made villain characters they had, the Boba Fett clone. I weaved him through all 4 years. He was their constant antagonist. And they would get together and like, we ran into Jodo Cast last week. Oh, you did? He totally took out our starship like a month ago. And like, they'd be sharing stories at lunch, you know, at dinner time in the cafeteria. They'd be all sharing these stories about what we've been going through the last few weeks and catching up on all their character stuff. It was the coolest thing.
Yeah.
And then so we rolled through it. And then finals week, everybody had their finals. We were all done by Wednesday, and the dorm didn't close until Friday. So we had 2 full days. And so this was our last hurrah. We had come up right to Endor, and they said, you know what? We all just kind of want to get together as a big party, but we want to have a game. And I'm looking at, you know, 28 people going, I have no idea how to run all of you people as a game. And then I realized the Star Warriors game was an awesome, it was, if you're not familiar with it, it was their hex-based starship game. I had huge maps printed out. I had a bunch of counters that I'd been using periodically, various ships. Mm-hmm. And we did the Battle of Endor. We had a table with this space battle going. We had a table with Endor, and they had a Rebel side mission going on at the same time that the events going on in the movie. So they had stuff that we kind of tied into that. Mm-hmm. And then we had a couple of characters who, throughout the course of this, we had people who came and then dropped out. So it wasn't like it was a constant number of people. I think the 4 original guys I started with, only 2 went through the entire 4 years. But I invited a couple of guys who had played characters and either went to the dark side or had gotten captured and turned and then disappeared or whatever, and brought them back as villains, as opponents. And they basically helped me run a couple of the different tables.
Nice.
So like, I had one guy run in the Imperial fleet for me. And I would just basically walk between the tables and make sure that everything's going cool. And I'd pull somebody else, like, pull somebody off the side and say, you just bought a Johto cast in a, you know, over here. And he'd be like, oh, we're going to go tear off after them. And then we pull off to a small table. And we played that, I think, for 33 hours straight.
Wow.
And we finished, and then we had a big old breakfast, and then that was it. It was the end of our college run. That was the most awesome thing I have ever done.
Yeah.
And it truly, I think it really did prepare me for, you know, 10 years later, I'd be writing for Battletech. Well, yeah, 10 years later, I'd be writing for Battletech. And that, I think, gave me the excitement level and brought back that whole crafting of story that I've loved so much, and that it just fueled that to no end.
That is incredible.
That is really awesome. I'm also excited that you mentioned Johto cast, because I was looking it up and I quickly realized he was the star, because I used to play, again, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I played the Cypher card game, and I actually got a card of Johto cast, and he was one of the stars of my Bounty Hunter deck, along with one of my, like, IG-88s and, like, another Bounty Hunter thing. And
nice.
Well, yeah, that whole Manhunt in Tatooine was awesome, because it had all of the one-offs, the exact same character, the exact same bounty hunters that you see in Empire, but they're all different characters. So they had the Dengar look-alike, they had the Bossk look-alike, the Trandoshan, they had an IG-84, I think, instead of 88. They had a Forlorn look-alike. It was like, if you look at the cover, it's all those bounty hunters, but you read inside, it's all different characters. And I thought that was the coolest, most hilarious thing ever, and I used them all.
Nice.
But Johto cast is the one who basically became the nemesis of probably about half the group.
That's awesome.
So
that is amazing.
That really is. So, that's great.
Okay, so end sidebar.
No, that's
that coolest sidebar ever. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. All right. Do we want to branch out a little bit from this and talk about how to incorporate Christianity in some specific ways in sci-fi games, just kind of ideas for for GMs to use, cool concepts, well, things like that?
Sure. Can I do it by conquering the very last one we have that actually uses basically Christianity in a sci-fi setting?
Of course.
Yeah.
And the last one that I thought of here on this list was Battlestar Galactica, and I'm not a huge fan or hugely knowledgeable about Battlestar Galactica, but I do know one thing. It was all about religion. Like, the humans had a religion that was this polytheistic, worshipping some, like, pantheon of gods. The Cylon robots actually had a religion, and interesting enough, the robots' religion was basically Judeo-Christianity. Like, they believed in monotheistic god who should not be named. This is a quote I have from a website on it. The Cylons believe God created humankind. Humanity to the Cylons is a flawed creation, one that is sinful and has essentially thrown away the gift of the soul and God's love. Cylons believe that God directly directed humanity to create the Cylons as a more perfect entity. Therefore, Cylons believe that they are to take the place of the flawed humans in the cosmos and become essentially the next generation of humankind. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. That's one of the things I liked about Battlestar Galactica, but to be honest, they totally threw it out the window at the last season, and the very end of it, how they ended it, totally soured me to the whole series.
I haven't watched the ending of Battlestar Galactica. It didn't grab me that much, even at the beginning, and like I can't speak to whether or not they messed it up, but it, just as we were thinking about these different things, is this is a way that you could bring in actual Christianity into it, because this is like this is a sci-fi story that has actual Christianity basically coded into it. It's not a 100% oh, this is Christianity, but like all the references are there.
Yeah, it doesn't take much to tweak it, certainly, and make it Christian.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially because Christianity and Judaism and Islam, that set of religions, specifically believes in a creator God. The question of the creator's relationship to what they have created is, I think, something you can always explore in a Christian science fiction game. It doesn't have to be Christian to explore that concept, certainly, but I think it's a little more interesting in that environment. Humanity has made something. What is humanity is now a creator. What does that mean? What is this new creation's relationship to God? what's the relationship with humans as this intermediary between their new creation and God? Things like that.
Well, like, it's interesting because, like, you have a group of beings that have absolutely no question about, like, the big things. Where did I come from? You came from a lab. Like, they have all the answers. And instead of becoming atheists, non-believers, they construct a belief system.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's they invent or maybe they adopt a religious belief to answer even questions that we didn't even know existed. Because, yeah, it's you don't have to look far. They made the series Caprica, which I think explained the creation of Cylons and why it happened.
Uh-huh.
Because some guy wanted his daughter back.
Yeah, things like that. I think you're right. That idea of a next generation of mankind, something to replace mankind, that like I was saying before, the creator-createe relationship, there's a lot of cool stuff there to explore. I don't know. I think that's something you could certainly use in a game. Do we want to start talking then about GMing ideas, essentially cool concepts, things like that?
There's very cool concepts, like, and there's been a couple of different themes that have gone through these, you know, different examples that we've put out. I could restate them, but...
No, I mean, everything we've talked about up to this point, I think, is something worth considering. I've had this idea in my head, really since we started planning this episode, that I can't get out of it, which is the idea of Christian missions to alien populations, which gives you the opportunity to... I don't know that it could be a game in and of itself unless you had a very specific, maybe short-termish game with a very specific group of people. But as a background...
As someone who has run a game centered around an Inquisitionary force in a religious area, you could do this as a long-standing game.
Okay.
You just have to have a religious-operated government that is going out and trying to impose their religion on the rest of the world.
Well, that's one way too, but you could also do it like in the District 9 sense, where you have, I'm assuming you've at least one of you have seen District 9, right?
Yes.
It's fantastic.
So, I mean, that's a possibility too, where you have an Earth-style government and who's maltreating or mistreating an alien refugee force. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe either a group of Christian missionaries or just Christian relief aid, or even if you do like a more militaristic, if you want to do a commando raid, but one of the characters is a, you know, very much a Christian, and he sees this inhumanity to these aliens. You know, how would he, and he was the commander of the force, you know, what would he do to fulfill the you know, the requisites of its mission, but yet still be human to these, you know, obviously mistreated aliens.
I'm going to talk in a language that no one but us hosts are going to understand, but imagine it's the Lanterns. I can see, like, Peter's, like, for those of you who don't know, the Lanterns is the religious organization that the characters of me, my girlfriend, Grant, and Peter belong to in Peter's game. And we just actually had another session of that, so woohoo! Let's keep it going.
There we go. two sessions in 3 months. We're on a roll.
Yeah.
But yeah, the thing is, like, I could very well see that if we took up just the area we have right there, I mean, and put it next to a group of aliens that suddenly crash landed on the planet, I could very well see us, like the group that we have, talking to them and trying to help them out, and while we're trying to help them out, you know, trying to convert them and, you know...
Well, that's pretty much what you guys are going to be embarking on your colony-establishing trip to do.
Yeah, it's just, they're not extraterrestrials.
Yeah,
it's you're just changing words around.
Yeah, the premise of the campaign, listeners, since part of the reason for the campaign is just so we can play a game and have fun, but part of it is to give us actual firsthand stuff to talk about on the podcast, too. So might as well start now. The basic storyline, at this point at least, is that the world has just reached the point where people have realized that they're on a planet and not a flat surface. And the church has kind of taken this realization by, like, turning pale and being like, oh dear, we've been neglecting half the world, you know? We need to fix this. There's people over there that might be suffering, or somebody go over there and make sure that if there's people there, they're okay. And that's going to be the player group. So, yeah, yep. you can definitely change that from fantasy to sci-fi. You know, it's like, now, granted, this requires that you have a very benevolent religious organization that you're a part of, but that's kind of what they're supposed to be, so...
Well, it doesn't require a benevolent, it just changes the flavor really different of the mission.
Yeah.
Like, because like I said, in my Inquisition game, the religion that my thing was based on was a benevolent religion. The church was not benevolent. And, right. Like, and the characters that we were playing with, since they were on an autonomous force, I let them decide whether they wanted to be benevolent or non-benevolent, and they reaped what they sowed.
Yeah. There's actually a sub-doctrine, if you will, of Christian and Judaic theology called exotheology. It's about the examination of theological issues pertaining to extraterrestrial intelligences. Hmm. There's at least one Catholic theologian, Corrado Balducci, who discusses this a fair bit. C.S. Lewis talked about it a little bit in some of his works. I think it came up in Mere Christianity. I know he published an article about it at one point. I know Lewis's stance was essentially, it may be that these aliens need salvation. They may not. They may not have fallen in the same way mankind has.
Mm-hmm.
Or their salvation could come in the form of Jesus Christ or some other entirely distinct plan unique to them. We don't know. We would have to meet an extraterrestrial and say, tell us about yourself, learn about them before we could say, do they know Christ? Do they know Christ already? Do they need to know Christ? Is God's plan for them entirely different? We don't know. I do like the idea of essentially a theological debate between, say, Christians, you know, who are human, and another alien species and their religion essentially arguing doctrinal points about their own salvation, saying, no, we're saved this way. It'd be like the arguments my wife and I have about infant baptism. These, you know, because she's Baptist, and Southern Baptists at least don't do infant baptism, whereas Presbyterians do. And, you know, we kind of talk about it some. It'd be, in a strange way, sort of that same scale of doctrinal debate. You know, and likewise, I like the idea that maybe there's a subset of people who can never believe that aliens are saved unless they are Christian. And you have conflict there.
Well, there's also another subsect that could happen because, this you bringing this up and about and making me say this got me thinking about a reading of Job I heard. I heard in one translation somewhere, mm-hmm. lost in the ethernet of my history and brain and stuff.
Sure.
That one of the translations said that God called all the atoms of all the worlds together. And Satan came from Earth. Basically, he called a council for all the other worlds, which implies there are other worlds out there.
Right.
And
well,
Satan's
that gets touched on a little bit in the Chronicles of Narnia, even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even in the Space Trilogy touches on that.
Oh, yeah. The Space Trilogy is very much, here are these other worlds, Earth is fallen, but it's right. One fallen world amongst these others.
Which may or may not be fallen. It could be that we were the only ones that fell, so that when we start preaching to the aliens, they go, yeah, that's great. We've talked to the guy.
Right. I actually really liked liked the way, actually, that C.S. Lewis treated that in the Space Trilogy. Essentially, Earth has gone dark. It's fallen. It's black. There's no information coming out of it. It's terrifying. It's lost. And there's this rumor among all the other planets that in that darkness, something incredible and wonderful has happened. And so when Lewis's protagonist leaves the planet, he's one of the first humans to leave the planet and go talk to other planets. And the aliens who hear about it marvel at the salvation of humanity offered by God in that way. Because it's something out of this darkness has come something even more amazing. It's a proof of how wonderful God is and how much love he has for his creation. I liked that take on it. So that's certainly another way to explore it. The interaction between alien species and humanity and human beliefs, there's a lot you can do there.
Yep.
Because it's different people interacting, and you now get to say, well, this belief of this alien culture can be as different as you like, because they don't need to have any shared... They didn't even grow up on the same planet as us, so...
Right, and you have the ultimate objective observer, somebody with no human experiences at all.
Well, he might not be an objective observer.
Well, okay,
he
you're
might
right.
be an entire like that's another thing I thought.
Say outside observer.
It could be someone who like he's not objective that just dislikes humanity because of all the special treatment it's gotten. You're the one who did bad, but yet he spends all of his time looking at you.
Which leads back into the sick need a doctor, not the healthy.
Right. Yeah. Christ. Why is this man Jesus spending time with sinners and wine bibbers and tax collectors and prostitutes? You have that same Pharisaical opinion that would be of humanity as a whole. I don't know. That'd be interesting.
This is something that I'm stealing. It's mine.
Yeah. No. That's all yours. I may have to steal that too. That's really clever.
Yeah,
you can't steal it. I've already stolen it. I'm guarding it.
Dang it. All right. It's his. All right.
Have Fair to enough. Mount a commando raid to take it back from him.
That's right. Oh, man. I don't know. Anybody? Ben, you had something.
Yeah. One of the, as we're talking about GM uses for Christianity in its sci-fi setting, too, is that let's not go extraterrestrial. Let's go post-apocalyptic. And let's look at a world 300 years from now where Christianity was oppressed and beaten down to the point where it's a minority religion. So
like
you have
Book
pockets
of Eli,
of,
for instance?
Like what?
The Book of Eli, that the movie. Have you seen that?
Oh, no, I've heard, I know the premise amazing. Of it. But yeah, I know the premise of it. I know the story. In essence, something like that. So, let's have a post-apocalyptic setting where Christianity and is no longer it's a threatened, it's a extinct religion where there's only a few practitioners and it's a sacred thing. If you had a character who had this belief or espousal, how would they interact within a society or a world that looks down on them, will turn them in at the closest minute, has nothing that wants to do with them, or is even just you have characters who are mildly questioning about this, how would you keep it secret? How would you go about doing that?
That sounds to me a lot like the stuff described in Revelations and Times. Like,
yeah, but I mean, if you go outside of that and step away from the typical left behind style of setting.
And let's do that because that series is terribly written.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so as a story crafter, I can't stand it. But anyway,
yeah.
So let's go in a different direction where, science is now a religion where, the practicality rule and rational thought rules overall. Mm-hmm. How would a Christian, what type of moral dilemmas could they face? What types of interactions would they have? How would they practice their faith in such a restricted society? If that's the setting that you have, that would be quite a challenge. And I think actually that type of setting, if I had a group of Christian friends who played Gimps, I wish to God that I had a group of Christians who played role-playing games around me. I would actually challenge them with that. They all played a Christian character in this very utopianistic, I guess, equilibrium style of setting. I don't know if you ever saw that movie with Christian Bale. I love that movie because of the setting and the questions it raises. How would you exist in that? How would you interact with that? And force them to kind of answer the questions that sometimes we don't want to face in that.
Right. Questions of practicality and, you know, efficiency versus what, you know, relationship to God. You know, well, this is easy and this is what's expected. And yeah, it's maybe the most economical solution, but is it right?
Right. And then, you know, also too, you know, if science was the new religion, how would a religion, which is now a minority, how would that face and interact with a society that where science is everything? Mm-hmm. I mean, what type of dichotomy would you have there?
Yeah. Or how do the two end up integrating, you know?
Or if you want to take an even darker tack on your setting, it's post-apocalyptic. People are not really able to rebuild because too many of the people who know how everything works have died. And instead of it being very rational, it's very nihilistic. And nobody really has much of any humanity left. What do you do in that setting?
Oh, right.
See, the more you talk about post-apocalyptic settings, the happier I get. Please continue.
That actually sounds like Lipkin's trilogy that he just put out the last 3 years, which is a very interesting series.
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with it.
Not familiar, yeah.
It is the Chivis trilogy, Chivis. Brian M. Litfin, Litfin. Mm-hmm. It's The Sword, The Gift, and I think The Kingdom is the third book. I like this series because the setting is very similar to, you know, what you were talking about. Technology is gone. The world has remade itself, but Christianity is very much a dead, hidden, despised religion.
Hmm.
So how do you, as a believer, you know, operate in such a thing?
Yeah.
How does it challenge your belief and faith and everything else?
Hmm.
Cool.
So anyway,
we'll have to,
food for thought.
Yeah, we'll have to
this
look at
that one. No, I'm looking at this, and it looks very interesting.
So do we have anything else on ideas for adding Christianity to a sci-fi setting or plots and conflicts?
The only thing that we haven't talked about is someone mentioned up at the very top, Dead Space's criticism of pseudo-faiths.
Yeah, I've been watching an actual play of Dead Space and Dead Space 2 because I cry like a little girl when I play horror games. I jump 6 feet in any random direction when anything startles me. My wife has knocked me down in the shower just by opening the door and saying, "Hey, Grant, I startle that easily." All right? It's terrible. But I can watch actual plays of it just fine for some reason. Don't know what the difference is.
It's in a little tiny window in the middle of the screen and you're expecting...
Oh, no. I try and get it as big as possible, turn out the lights, etc. I think it's because the guy I watch play the game, Jesse Cox, is really funny and makes it worthwhile.
Well, yeah, and also...
you're disassociated, too.
There's a bit of separation between you and the character. You're not the one who's walking the character down the hall. And when the thing jumps out at you, no matter how much you react, nothing you do is going to change what happens.
Yeah, I think that helps. Also, instead of playing the game, I'm sitting on the couch with my wife laughing at it. So that helps. But anyway, I've been watching this playthrough of Dead Space. And one of the big things about Dead Space is the religion that sort of drives the plot in Dead Space and Dead Space 2 is kind of a send-up and expose, almost, of Scientology. This very kind of corrupted, man-made faith. It's kind of a criticism of that. And I don't so much want to talk about Dead Space, necessarily, so much as the idea of kind of these pseudo-faiths like that are sort of a modern invention. I'm not saying that created religions like this are new or modern. emperors have been declaring themselves gods since time immemorial.
Ancient Egypt, at least.
Yeah. These pseudo-faiths tend to reflect their time and the setting and mindset of the culture they grow out of in very particular ways. Scientology, for example, is aliens and pay money and move up in the church. You know, it's secular power and money and aliens did it. And that says a lot about the culture that Scientology came out of. So if you have other religions that aren't Christianity, think about what they're coming out of. What needs are they meeting? Why is this... If it's popular, why is it popular? If it's a sect, why is it not taking hold of the mainstream? If you're looking at how Christianity might have changed over 300, 500, 1,000 years, you know, certainly Christianity has evolved over time, you know, as our understanding of humanity's relationship with God deepens as we, you know, grow technologically, that sort of thing, as our understanding of the world increases. How does Christianity change over time? How does it continue to stay relevant in the future you're imagining? That's something I think you have to take into account when you're creating, when we're talking about any sort of religion in any science fiction game. But pay special attention to that when you're talking about Christianity, because if you take modern Christianity as it is today and drop it 1,000 years into the future, it's going to feel quaint and anachronistic. Am I making sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, except I would challenge that in the sense that, I mean, we're already 2,000 years removed from the basis of it to begin with. Mm-hmm. And several opponents of Christianity would say that it's too anachronistic and too quaint. Mm-hmm. And therefore, because it fails in adequacy to resolve issues that can be easily answered by science, I guess this is full circle from when we started at.
Right, and I'm not...
So, you know, and that's where the proponents of... So that's where you have to actually look deeper in that the core tenet, the core essence of what Christianity really is, still resonates. And that's why it's still... That's why it is still around today, and so... I guess.
Yeah, I can't really see a scenario in which humanity has gotten beyond the point where we do bad things that hurt each other. We need forgiveness. You know, we need to know why we're here and what comes after we die.
Right.
I realize there's so much more to Christianity than that, but those are some of the big core things that our faith answers for us.
Yeah, and I'm not talking about changing the core message at all, obviously.
Yeah.
But I'm saying...
Well, the customs and stuff will certainly change.
Yeah, customs, trappings, specific questions like what's the Catholic doctrine as it relates to artificial intelligences? Things like that.
Well, and here's something else to consider. A lot of the stuff that we consider to be, like, a core part of the... I guess, like, the aesthetics or the trappings or, you know, kind of the flavor of modern Christianity has been around for less than a quarter of Christianity's lifespan.
Right.
Amazing Grace is less than 500 years old.
Sure.
Yeah, what I would actually say, you know, in the sense, in the ways that it seems antiquated and, you know, quaint, the people who say, you know, it's about, you know, how women dress or the... quote-unquote deep theological things that people challenge, you know, what Paul writes in his letters. Those were things that were specific to that time and specific to that period and answered specific questions that were brought up by believers of that time and of that age.
Right.
Those, unfortunately, turned into doctrine by some, both proponents and opponents. I think if you took Christianity and moved it 2,000 years into the future... and take humanity and move it 2,000 years in the future, what would Christianity look like? If you keep the tenets and the core essence of the faith the same, which is how it's continued to maintain itself. I mean, that's how it has maintained for the last 2,000 years.
Right.
What around that would change to accommodate or to work with or to mesh with society at that point? And that's an interesting, challenging question.
Yeah, it's just it's not something maybe that GMs want to spend a lot of time on, but they need to be aware that, you know, when you go to church and you look around and you see stained glass windows or folding chairs or whatever, you know, whatever your church looks like, it may look completely different 2,000 years in the future. You know, and right. Some of those outward trappings should be changed to make it believable within the setting. It needs to be internally consistent.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, because, you know, 2,000 years ago, the church body was a group of people in a mud hut dried stone hut in, you know, the Middle East. And it was Constantine who brought about the church concept as a stone building and a cathedral, you know, and brought about that concept. And, you know, it's constantly evolving. And now, you know, it's going back into, you know, the progression into home church or small groups or, you know, more modern buildings and so on and so forth. You know, the outward trappings continually change.
Yeah, a lot of the mega churches just look like office complexes.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Or stadiums. You know, and it's so, yeah, the challenge is, you know, if you are looking at a game and you're putting yourself into a setting that is that far out, you know, keeping the essence of the faith consistent, how would actually it completely change and look regarding and interact with the setting that you have? Because what you have today is not going to be the same as it would be that far forward.
And exactly. The other thing is, if you've projected it that far forward, stuff that looks like it does today that's still around will have the same sense of, like, historical weight and reverence that walking into a centuries-old cathedral will have for a modern person.
That's very true. Yeah. That's very true.
Okay.
Wow. So I think we just went full circle.
I think we did. I think this is a good place to wrap it up.
Yeah. All
right. Anybody else have anything?
I think this is one of the best episodes we have ever done, though. I can't wait to see the edited version of this.
Thank you so much
for coming on, Ben. This was fantastic.
Absolutely. Thank you.
But thanks for having me. I love it.
Yeah.
Anytime you guys want to do another, this was a lot of fun. If you guys have another topic you want to discuss or anything along those lines, I don't have a lot of opportunity to be a Christian gamer. I don't like using Christianity as an adjective or as a descriptor. It's a way of life for me. But to be able to share a hobby that I thoroughly enjoy, such as gaming, because, you know, my wife, I love her immensely, but this is not her hobby.
Yeah, mine either.
And so I have a lot of friends who, you know, I love dearly and interact with them on almost daily basis. And we play different types of games, and some of them know my faith, and some will be very surprised with this podcast when I tell them. Very surprised to where I stand, because I'm very private and I'm very reserved in, you know, how I, you know, communicate with that. But to be able to discuss issues like this, I've never really had that opportunity before. To be honest, I thoroughly enjoyed this. And, you know, a setting like this is great. I think what you guys are doing, why I was so excited and contacted Grant to begin with, is something like this, I think, is needed for the gaming community, because there are a lot of us out there that I believe really need that bolster, even if it's just a, hey, there are other guys out there, and being a Christian and playing games is okay.
Yeah.
It's not the devil's work, you know? It's not, I can go into my church and not feel like they're looking at me weird because I just played, you know, I told them about my foray in Borderlands last night, you know?
A Christian and a gamer is also okay. You know, you can go to church on Sunday, and, you know, it's like Christianity and science. They're two groups that sit there glaring at each other that don't need
to. And it's funny because, you know, I am to be surprised how old I am. It's funny because, you know, I interact with people at church, and, you know, when they find out that I play video games like Halo and Borderlands, and I read comic books, and I write and play science fiction, and, you know, I listen to techno music, they're like shocked. They're like, and yet you're a strong Christian in this church. I'm like, yeah, it's because I'm normal. I said, you know, I'm normal. It's okay to do these things because ultimately it comes down to where is your relationship with Christ? Where is your relationship with God and your interaction with him? Where are your priorities? I don't let games rule my life. I don't let the writing rule my life. I don't let all these other things, you know, work or anything, and all these other addictions and other things that the people put in place of the Lord, you know, that's what interrupts their lives. And sometimes people are reluctant to admit, you know, that there are things on this world that, I mean, God created games. God, you can go into the Bible and I can find quite a bit of instances where games are in play here. You know, because the art of playing, the art of game, it's a God-given thing. It's not from the devil. It's not something sinful. It's something that's to be enjoyed with family, with friends, with people of faith. There's nothing wrong with it. And, you know, what you guys are doing, I think, is great. It's nice to sit down and talk with people who have similar experiences and to share that and to understand, you know, that our faith is not an impediment to play. Mm-hmm. Our faith is
enhancement in a lot of cases.
That's the word I was looking for. It's the enhancement to our play.
Yeah.
And I think it enriches not only ourselves at the table, but I think it enriches everybody at the table. And that, I think, is what that's what God wants from us, is to show him through us to in these things that we enjoy with other people so that they can see God is cool. God is just as much for them, for the gamer, as he is for the devout.
It's very well said. Yeah.
Yeah.
I,
you've pretty much summed up the mission statement of our podcast. So yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
Great. So yeah, all that to say, you know, if you want me on again, if you have another topic you want to talk about, I am more than willing to, I would love to do it again.
Yeah. I think we're going to go invent some real quick.
Yeah. No kidding.
All right. We're going to have another interview with Ben Rome. The topic,
something that we just came up with that we're not even sure of. Give us a second.
There we go. All right. Well, Ben, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah.
I will say real
thanks,
quick,
guys.
If you're looking for a community of Christian gamers, our Google Plus community is really good. I don't know how you feel about online gaming, but there's a lot of really awesome people in that community.
Yeah, well, it's one more social network I really don't want. I just want to keep it to Facebook and LinkedIn. And
that's fair. That's fair.
You know, it's just an overindulgence is not a good thing. But
that's true.
You know, it's good to know that there are options out there for other people. You know, I have my circle on the 360 that, you know, we play with. And, you know, if I ever make it to another convention again, which who knows if that'll ever happen. But, you know, I'd love to sit down and play with you guys. It'd be great.
Awesome. Yeah. See if you can get Catalyst to send you out and demo Battletech at Fear the Con or something.
Yeah.
I think Hussey's been trying to get them for a while.
So,
See? Perfect. All right. Well, Ben, thank you very much for coming on with us. We really appreciate it. Thanks for putting up with us for till what, 10 o'clock tonight? Goodness.
No problem.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
We're going to wrap that extremely high-quality episode here, folks.
Yeah. I got nothing else. Guys, thanks for listening. And unless anybody has anything else, I think we're going to wrap this up and just say we'll see you next time.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right.
See ya.
This has been a production of Saving the Game. Copyright 2013. This podcast may be redistributed under a Creative Commons non-commercial, non-derivative license, provided that credit is given to savingthegamepodcast.org. Our music is by Ryan Humphrey. For past episodes, podcast news from our hosts, or to connect with us, visit our website at savingthegamepodcast.org. God bless, and happy gaming.